Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. Septième épisode, conférence de Antje Winner, Cultural Cosmopolitanism, Contestedness and Contestation.
To say I'm a hamburger, so I mean that joke is already taken. I'm very glad that I've been invited to this, and like Robin, I thought, you know, I would beat Robin. Where, you know, there, in, you know, having come late to the crowd of JTs. But I can say for myself that we had a few near meetings here in Montreal in the early 90s, but then we didn't meet. And it lasted until 2007 or something, when Joe Shaw told me, well, you have to meet this guy, Jim Tully. He seems to be saying very similar things that you do. I think it was the other way around, but that's the way she put it. And I cannot say that certainly Jim was a major force in, like Robin said in the morning, giving me confidence when I had amassed 1,000 pages of a text corpus and I had to do discourse analysis on it. I was ready to throw that in the bin. But that's now the invisible constitution of politics, and I tried to map meaning. It was kind of a horrendous task, but Jim kind of said, you should do it. It's a good idea. Go ahead. Do it. I did it. So, well, thanks to the organizers, to Dimitri especially. Dimitri was actually responsible for the NIA meeting in the 1930s, when 1993, when he hooked me up with a citizenship group at McGill. And Charles Taylor and Jim Tully were these tremendous figures in the back that we as PhD students, well, we wouldn't dare, you know, approach them. So that was then. Now we are here, and I'm not sure whether I should be daring to actually talk about what happened in the meantime. But let me say, I'm not a political theorist, I'm not a philosopher, I'm a critical constructivist in IR theorists. I work on soft institutions such as norms, principles, and routinized practices. That's kind of my field. And as a social science discipline, IR is generally more oriented actually towards problem solving in a way that IR seeks answers rather than, you know, actually engaging with practice the way I think David put it yesterday. And IR is not really engaged with raising normative or critical questions. Now, from that field, I promote a bifocal approach that works with an ongoing reflexive interrelation between empirical research and normative theorizing. And that's kind of the point where, of course, I cannot do without public philosophy. And today, my contribution is going to be, why and how does PPNK matter for international relations theories? And the background against which I want you to read this presentation is to see the juxtaposition of two ontologies: the community ontology, which is sort of most of my IR colleagues are very fond of, and the diversity ontology, which I take from Jim's work. Now, my argument here is that culture has been edited out of political science, pretty much. And to bring culture back in, so to speak, with reference to PPNK, by applying core philosophical observations from public philosophy to international relations theories, I'm going to proceed in three steps. I'm kind of trying to kind of edit them back in. Now, step one looks at practices, regulatory versus cultural practices. Then step two looks at cosmopolitanism, political versus cultural cosmopolitanism, where cultural cosmopolitanism is presented as one of three thinking tools, and it's kind of my main argument. And step three is about contestation, where I juxtapose the societal pattern that sociological constructivists are looking for and the norm generative practice that I take from PPNK. And then I present a conclusion on contestedness as a meta-organizing principle of global governance. Now, step one. The regulatory versus cultural. I took that from Jim's work on strange multiplicity when he looked at constitutional practices, and we've just had the discussion now about the regulatory versus the critical. I work with two assumptions here, which are central in PP and K, that guide the project of bringing culture back in. The first assumption is, as Jim says in PP and K, morality belongs to culture. That's the first point. And the second assumption is that citizens must be able to engage in intercultural dialogue, and that's much better defined, as Jim says, a multilogue. I was a bit surprised the concept of multilogue wasn't really addressed so far. People were always talking about dialogue. I think multilogue is the better term. Now, for example, with regard to constitutionalism, it follows then that, first, constitutions are not per se legitimate or impartial, as Jim says. Instead, they are contingent. Now, to study that contingency, we need to understand constitutional practices not predominantly as regulatory, but also as cultural practices. And the cultural is always understood in a thin version of culture as the accumulated experiences of the day-to-day, kind of the background experiences of the individual. And the second is the interaction amongst the involved actors is therefore properly called a multilogue. Now, the question which I wish to raise here is, which difference does this insight make to studying international relations? So far, we have pretty much talked about domestic issues, politics, in bounded national contexts. I'm talking about international relations, and I define inter/national relations as interactions amongst diverse type of actors with different cultural roots. Now, this insight then facilitates studying international relations as reenacting normative structures of meaning and use. And while we have seen in international relations theories an opening up quite substantial towards discursive approaches. Everybody does discourse theory these days. And so these really have broadened the methodological toolbox, sometimes so much so that I kind of regret ever having introduced my students to doing that, because they are so much into the deep nitty-gritty kind of discourse analysis that they forget about the big questions in politics. And they should be able to actually use discourse analysis to prevent sort of the Ukraine crisis to happen and stuff like that. And I think it is possible. So while IR's opening up into discursive approaches has broadened the methodological toolbox towards reconstructing invisible structures of meaning in the Derridean sense and their effect on especially state behavior, the reverse perspective of how to actually bring diversity to the negotiating table has not been pursued in a similar way. So there we are with diversity, but if we consider diversity as a precondition that's necessary for legitimacy, then we have to think about how we can do that. And by applying the public philosophy perspective to IR, my own work on contestation seeks to counter that void. Now, and hence the call for reconstructive empirical research on the distinct cultural background experiences in international relations with a view to facilitating access to participation at the negotiating table for diverse international actors. And this is, of course, the reconstruction of the multilogue, who's actually already there. So we need to do empirically, what we need to do is we need to map meaning. Mapping meaning, mapping meaning, mapping meaning. I can only repeat that, and that's the thing that is quite a daunting empirical task, because we need to figure out how we actually talk to people so that they reveal the kind of meanings that they travel around with, their normative baggage. People will not tell you, if you ask a worker, are you a worker, they will not say, I'm a worker, I'm a working class member, but you have to figure out a different way of addressing that question, and this usually involves expressive interviews and all sorts of relatively complicated and time-consuming research to account for this invisible background experience. The result is then that we can obtain an account of normative structures of meaning and use in different contexts of global governance. So to summarize this first step is the assumption about diverse cultural roots of morality and the argument that multilog is required to generate legitimacy are the background for my own theory of contestation. And before I get to this kind of the contours of this theory, well, I modestly called it a theory, as we know, theories are always in progress. They are never finished. So that's why I thought it's important to call it a theory, because it has a claim for being more than practice. It's also about norms. Now, I wanted to turn to explain why I use cultural cosmopolitanism as a thinking tool. And this is the second juxtaposition, political versus cultural cosmopolitanism. I use thinking tools from public philosophy as a method. Anna Leander has sort of promoted that method in international relations. And I work with three thinking tools, which I, upon close inspection, I actually took them all out of Jim Tully's public philosophy. The first is the normativity premise, which I take out of the Unfreedom of the Moderns, of course, which means that for IR, research on norms need to focus on both the normal, the taken-for-grantedness that all my social constructivist colleagues are working on, and the normative. And that's the negotiated normativity of norms. And that's usually what in IR you don't have sort of as a focus. The second is the diversity premise, which I take out of Strange Multiplicity, and which for IR would say international relations are located within a global context where formal political borders and invisible cultural boundaries do not necessarily overlap. We had that in Chuck's talk yesterday. The social imaginaries will sort of guide us in what we expect to happen in the other place, and that's what I call the normative baggage that we travel with, and often pretty sort of lonely with our own normative baggage as we change places. And then we run into a lot of contestations and misunderstandings. But these can be used in a constructive, positive way. Therefore, my claim here is that despite ongoing globalization, international relations need to be understood and will remain to be understood as intercultural relations. And then the third thinking tool is cultural cosmopolitanism, which I take out of the second volume of PP&K. And cultural cosmopolitanism, of course, I mean, here the summary is somewhat blatant, but it argues that both contestation as a political practice, which is strategic, and public questioning of norms that we just had about the civil, and contestation as a cultural practice, spontaneous disagreement with normative meaning, which is the civic, are constitutive for normative order. And, of course, this is something to say about domestic context, and it's quite a different thing to try to argue that for the global realm. Now, here I argue that the definition of cosmopolitanism as cultural builds on two central claims which have been advanced by bifocal research, both in public philosophy, and here's where I marry public philosophy with IR, critical IR theory, where public philosophy would, according to public philosophy, cultural cosmopolitanism is considered as a logical extension of the constitutive impact of cultural practices, which have been brought to the fore from, and Jim has put that very nice, from underneath the regulative map of modernity. And that's the thing about maps and you know, the map of modernity, what's underneath, what's on it, what's not on it, and how can our mapping meaning actually make us sort of allow us to steer in a way that's more aware of what's actually going on in other places. And secondly, what's coming from IR is that cultural cosmopolitanism is a practical consequence of the dimension of cultural validation of norms as the individual practice of reenacting normative meaning and use by mobilizing socio-cultural background experience at the implementation stage. This means that despite the taken-for-grantedness of human rights and sometimes R2P and everything else, once it comes down to implementing a norm at the implementing stage, individuals will have their own individual views. They will have not only interests, which, of course, positivist political science is fond of sort of calculating, but also the invisible background experiences which actually make us sort of turn in favor or against implementing norms. And so by highlighting the norm-generative impact of cultural practice, that's kind of the big point that I see coming out of Jim's work. The concept of cultural cosmopolitanism fleshes out the leading claim of my theory of contestation, namely that a given community cannot be taken for granted in 21st century international relations. And it will not be taken for granted. It will not come up in the future, even though we have people like Habermas who are fond of thinking that they are possible. So therefore, the legitimacy of fundamental or metanorms depends on the very conditions under which their normativity is negotiated, morally justified, and contested. And this is, in a sense, where I come in with contestation. And let's move to the third step, where I argue, in a sense, for contestation all the way down, not just contestation at the constitutive stage, where philosophers talk about the virtues and values of fundamental norms, but contestation all the way down through the referring stage and the implementing stage. Now, the theory of contestation, here I juxtapose societal patterns with which my colleagues here at McGill work, Vincent Pouliot and Emmanuel Adler, of course, in Toronto. They see kind of a structured society where people practice the known, and therefore, and they call this that's kind of a way of enhancing security because you already know how to behave. The representational patterns, the societal patterns are given. Now, against that, I argue that practices are norm generative. And that's, I think, an important claim because in that way, contestation has two functions. At once, it's necessary to indicate disagreement of critical comment on the norms of governance. So that's as an indicator. And the second is they are also required. Contestation is also required in order to actually establish legitimacy of those very norms as well. Now, the question, of course, is what is contestation? I'm not sure, Robin, whether I follow you along the hard kind of political protest, violence, dissidence. I think that's taking it too far. In the end, contestation is everything. And that was kind of my motivation to write this little book on a theory of contestation. First of all, of course, we agree contestation is a social activity. It's mostly, however, not exclusively expressed through language. And then generally, contestation entails objection to specific issues that matter to people. So in that sense, I'm with you there, Robin. Now, in international relations, contestation by and large involves the range of social practices which discursively express a disapproval of norms somewhere. I mean, we have it all the time, especially with R2P. Now, here we have a problem since we have lawyers, sociologists, political scientists working on norms, and a lawyer will say, well, R2P is not a legal norm, therefore I'm not interested in working on it, or until it becomes a legal norm. And I would say it is an organizing principle that's a mid-range principle that brings people to the table by way of saying we agree that we have a responsibility and we need to talk, but the outcome of this, how we do it, remains open. So what I suggest here is that we have to distinguish amongst types of norms in order to be able to talk in an interdisciplinary way. So rather than saying my norm is a foundation norm and yours is a meta norm and mine is a social and the culture, whatever norm. Norms are always social, by the way, so that's a tautology that people are just not getting rid of. Now, I distinguish amongst types of norms according to, one, their moral reach, and two, their degree of contestation. So then we have fundamental norms like sovereignty, democracy, human rights. They have a broad moral reach, their taken for grantedness can sort of matches the value of the norm, and they have a very low degree of contestation at that level. At the lower level, type 3 norms, standardized procedures, have a very narrow moral reach. Fritz Kratochwill, a leading international relations theorist, has once compared them with, you know, a flat pack of furniture, where you just, if the description isn't very specific, then you will never be able to put up your shelf. So in a sense, or consider them fishing quotas. You know, the fundamental norm in this case would be sustainable fishery. The standardized procedure, the narrow reach, and the high degree of contestation would, of course, be the quota and the mesh size, where that's where fishing folks start quarreling. And that's where normally I would start giving a talk about the turbot war in Canada and all the rest of it, but we don't have time to do that. The most important aspect here is that between these two types of norms, which are well addressed in the literature, there is a third type, which I call organizing principles, and which cover a legitimacy gap, which exists between the larger sort of moral fundamental norms on the one hand and the type 3 norms. And the question then is how to fill that legitimacy gap. I hear that I have 2 minutes. My suggestion in the theory of contestation is that we need to establish regular access to contestation for stakeholders. And that's a project in the book I do it with a reference to various governance sectors where you can derive through empirical research the organizing principles such as, for example, common but differentiated responsibility in climate governance and see how or corporate social responsibility that have actually been constructed through interaction in these sectors. So, and then you can establish those principles and see how they actually work. Which leads me, and I'm allowed to come to my conclusion here, I guess, to the claim of saying that contestation is an ongoing process. Through reenacting normative meaning in use, normative structures change in interaction with norm contestations. And while norms do have a structuring effect, they are living structures and they reflect a plural actorship. And secondly, contestation is potentially possible at each stage in the compliance process with regard to each segment of a norm. And if we agree that norms are always contestable, then different from Pettit, who considers contestability as the freedom from domination, I would define a meta-organizing principle of contestedness as the basis for assuming that norms are always contested, and therefore we must think about institutional procedures of facilitating regular access to contestation so as to use the diversity in order to enhance the legitimacy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.